If auguries augur well, the auguries look good for me today. I woke up singing. Singing? Augur that, my disbelieving friends. I've got no proof, of course. Only I heard myself. My father's song, his favourite, bellowed while kitchen razor blading his corns. Many brave hearts are asleep in the deep, so beware, beware. Beware. I mustn't push the auguries too far. To wake up singing isn't that extraordinary. Children often do it, old folk frequently, and lunatics are prone to sing and sleep and wake and sleep and sing. Larks are notorious for dawn sweetening, and corncrakes even startle the daybreak, competing with shrill roosters. Still, it's a satisfactory start. There's possibility of love, hope, freedom in my day, when I, who yesterday devoured the dark with dark disfigurings, distract myself this morning honourably, erring my father's heir. Awake, brave heart, holler your hope defiantly. The new dawn dawns with daunting possibilities. Many brave hearts. My father's song, one of his songs. How many did he sing? 50, 100, more possibly. Though nothing like mother's total of over 1,000 songs. Part of the ritual of life in the city of my childhood, Dublin. City of James Joyce, city of Sean O'Casey, city of Brendan Behan, city of Samuel Beckett, city of my father, Michael Payne, of my mother, Anne Payne, and city of myself, Basil Payne, Dubliner, voyager, voluntary exile, father, writer, solo dramatic performer, and poet. And what is a poet, you may ask? And my answer? Well, a maker. A maker with words of rhythms and images that sing. One who sings his joy and his pain, his love and his loss, his hope and his regret, his isolation and his self-discovery. Just as my father did in his way, and just as my mother did in her way. Mother, singer of 1,000 songs, in the kitchen, as she worked from dawn to dusk. Songs of love, songs of exile, songs of war, songs of peace, operatic arias, music hall ditties, Irish ballads, English ballads, American ballads, songs of the 30s, songs of the 40s, songs of the 50s, songs of the 60s. A melody and a theme for every half hour of the day. And still singing on a deathbed, as those around her marvelled and wept with sorrow and with humble awe. My mother chanted love songs as she worked about the house. Stoking the kitchen range, she sang of Barbara Allen's consumptive lover, spilling his heart's blood in an enamel basin. Ember refracted, mother's blood glowed through her cheekbones. Astride her back, her auburn plaits for reins, my child hands guided each domestic task. Her wedding ring made music on the washboard. Each day was spick and spanless, as the white nape of her neck between my thumbs and fingers. Often her vibrant coloratura of voice jangled an Irish ballad, Barney O'Hay. Bouncing in rhythm on her shoulder blades, I yelled the jaunty, comforting refrain, "Leave me alone, I know you won't, I know you won't, I know you won't. Leave me alone, I know you won't, impudent Barney O'Hay." Singing my mother's songs to my own children, words once enamel bright, congeal with grief. But blithe as hers, my separate distress jog trots the exuberant refrain. Leave me alone, though I know you won't, I know you won't, I know you won't. Leave me alone, though I know you won't. I know you won't. I know you won't. Leave me alone, don't leave me alone. The plea of the young, the plea of the old, of the sad, of the glad, the plea of everyone, everywhere. Leave me alone, don't leave me alone. Do respect my uniqueness, but don't abandon me in my isolation. isolation and togetherness, the flux and crux of life. Leave me alone, though I know you won't. My mother was a celebrator of life, a born celebrator, despite hardship and suffering and isolation. Her whole life was structured in ritual, domestic ritual. Peeling potatoes, scraping carrots, skinning a dead rabbit, black eye-popping eyes for rabbit stew, polishing the brass letterbox and brass doorknob on the hall door, adding colza oil to the red altar lamp, which burned day and night before her cherished symbol of love, the Sacred Heart picture above the mantelpiece, Jesus, meek and humble of heart, make my heart like unto thine. And singing, singing all the time, singing as she worked, singing as she consoled, singing as she fretted, singing as she grieved, singing all the day. Ritual, the mortar of life in the Dublin of my childhood, ritual of song, ritual of talk, ritual of drink, ritual of prayer, ritual of memory, ritual of death, ritual of the past, the glorious, glorious past. Ritual, the powerful link between man and wife, mother and child, child and mother, and less frequently, child and father. Watching my father shaving in the kitchen before a wall mirror, this was my 4 years old highlight in our otherwise humdrum daily domestic ritual. Mother sliced onions, grey eyes smarting with tears, all scarlet-faced, black-leaded the kitchen range, polished the steel pans with fine-grained emery paper. Later, she'd do the wash in a zinc bathtub, stiffen father's half-dozen shirt collars with robin starch. Father was dapper, starch collar, bow tie, trim moustache. Watching him shaving made my intestines tighten, my eyeballs harden with awe, my heartbeats quicken. That evil steel cutthroat razor, supposing it slipped on Dad's Adam's apple, sliced it off, plop, like that. What would I do? Rush out to the clothesline for Mother? Pick it up from the floor, stick it back on his bleeding throat. It never happened, of course. Silent as ordered, I'd watch him scrape creamy lather from his cheeks, chin, neck, such expertise, then finally throat. A daily miracle. There now, the razor snapped shut. I'm sure your mother could do with your help outside. Between us, once more, we'd outsmarted honed-up tragedy. Father died, having breakfast, from natural causes, the coroner's verdict recorded. My electric razor purrs. My young son complains it causes TV interference. Father and son, childhood, parenthood, talk, what we do to one another, words, the miracle of language, the menace of language, the voyage of discovery for every child and every poet everywhere. And who are the poets? But all those who refuse to abdicate the wonder, the uniqueness of childhood. Language and silence, language or silence, words, what we do to one another. A civilization of words, is it a civilization distraught? Possibly. When the murderer's gun and the murderer's bomb and the gas chamber and the napalm and the slogan and the lie prevail and assail, then, possibly, then, nothing speaks more eloquently than silence. To perish by silence, a consummation devoutly to be wished. Know and know again. Let the poet purify, not perish. Purify the heartache, purify the sob in the back bedroom, purify the stone in the heart, purify the shout in the street. Purify and pave the path to posterity. Oh, if we were only all suddenly everyone else. If. Then maybe what? Maybe we'd all be more real. Or maybe we'd all go mad, like, say, the Lady of Shalott, or William Blake, dazzled by the reality of the tiger burning bright in the forests of the night, Or like John Clare in his North County Asylum, or like Vincent van Gogh, or James Clarence Mangan, or Edgar Allan Poe, or Charles Baudelaire, or John Berryman, or Sylvia Plath, or all the lonely and all the lost, all those who put their heads into ovens, or simply decline into drink or decline, or withdraw into silence, silence ultimate and terrifying. No, away from everything that separates us from others, back instead, back to all that joins us to others and otherness. Old Mrs. McGinty, the alcoholic widow who lived in number 57, 9 doors from our own house on the terrace. Mrs. McGinty with her stooped back and foul-smelling gangrenous leg, the leg that gave her the dreadful privilege of involuntary isolation from others, isolation from neighbours, isolation from children, isolation from language, isolation from love, isolation from life. Mrs. Maisie McGinty's swollen leg, gone gangrenous from untreated gout, smelled vilely. She'd hoarded a keg of whiskey and a cask of Guinness stout beside her in our parlour, where all day she peered, tallow-faced, yellow-eyed, through filthy curtains, unlaundered since her husband passed away 3 years before in his sleep. Since then, unburdened by butcher's or baker's call, she lived on liquor and neighbours' occasional gifts. Meantime, her leg swelled bigger, the smell grew worse. The neighbours, cheery of charity, turned a less responsive eye on her lack of food and medical attention. A few persisted, but that smell prevailed like the gates of hell against the good intentions. That smell, it clung worse than dung, rotten fish, or a dish of pig's cheek left aside for a week and only discovered by the stench from the cupboard. Open the windows, open the doors, Mrs. McGinty dresses her sores. Still keeping the hearse on the old never-never, she bombarded her liver with whiskey and stout, till her savings ran out. Still her pension sufficed to keep her throat moist with Johnny Jump Up and an old dodge, a sup of red biddy mixed with aspirin. Twixt her pain and her thirst, she would frequently burst into blasphemous curses, till neighbourly purses soon opened wide, each competing to hide, by a good Christian act, the functional fact that a functioning nose makes charity doze. Thus enriched, her face twitched in sly glee. On her spree she would hug a delf jug of black creamy stout, puff her flattened chest out as her husband once did when he won a few quid on horses or cards. All gamblers are bards of freedom and song, and it would be wrong to condemn him because he disported his jaws on pint glasses and songs of the grand rebel throngs who defied the old Saxon till they turned their backs on the 26 counties of Erin. The bounties of freedom were vague, but Powers, Jemisons, Haig, and Guinness galore sufficed as before to make decent men mate in a chorus of hate for the terrible fate of Wolfe Tone, Padraic Pearse, Robert Emmet, and worse, teenage Kevin Barry. But by the Lord Harry, Patrick McGinty left comfort and plenty to shoulder his gun like a bold Irish man, who'd begrudge him his nip. But you're losing your grip on your memory. Pat's dead. It's his widow instead, who chants rebel songs to uncorset life's wrongs, and forces her pain like stale booze down the drain, as she waits for her turn to sprout wings, or to burn in life ever after, still swilling black porter, if deathbed repentance can't forestall the sentence, in the final shake-up, wake up, Maisie, wake up. A day or two later, nothing could slake or intensify thirst, dry-reaching and bursting gangrenous sores, pain seeped from her pores. Then, aware of her smell and her hell, she would yell through the cobwebby window, limp to the door and roar abuse at young boys for their joys and their noise, playing hopscotch, all top-notch in limb and in vigour, while her leg swelled still bigger, old Maisie the swigger, relict of McGinty, sweet 80. Hopscotch, Maisie, hopscotch, hopscotch. What a botch of a way to die. Which she did, by and by. Poor Maisie McGinty. Poor all of us. All of us who open our eyes and ears and hearts and bleed to death. Or all of us who close our eyes and our ears and hearts and freeze to death. How to redress this imbalance? How to survive the predicament, the privilege of being human? Not all survive, of course. Which are the survivors? Which are the non-survivors? One would need to be God to decide which. How to classify, for instance, Mr. and Mrs. Isaacs, the elderly Jewish couple who came to Dublin in my childhood, the childless couple who kept to themselves, who made it to freedom in time, away from the concentration camps, away from the gas chambers, away from the final solution, away from obscene naked processions, away from Auschwitz and Buchenwald and Belsen, away from the barbed wire and sickly smelling fires, away from the armbands and the helmets and the gun turrets, away from the desperate despair, away to neutral, Christian, sanctimonious Ireland, the island of saints and scholars, where such atrocities could never happen. Or could they? Could they? Who can probe the labyrinth of the human heart, where good and evil track each other with obtuse persistence? Who can claim their hearts are pure, or will be? Who can say, I am innocent, my hands are clean? Mr. and Mrs. Isaacs lived at number 10. They'd fled from Hitler. Both spoke awkward English, yet managed nicely on their modest business, hairdressing, with a money-lending sideline. Unlicensed and with prosecution pending, the neighbours found them gassed, their windows sealed, against their worse than Auschwitz Irish Judas. Meanwhile, in Europe, naked children shuffled behind naked Jewish parents in obscene procession to the more communal gas chambers, the daily trek to death, the final solution, the final dissolution. Was this then the end of my childhood, or was it the beginning of awareness, the beginning of my journey from innocence to experience, from light to dark and back to light again? The beginning of my dimly perceived awareness that we must love one another or die. Love one another or we are already dead. Love one another or we can never come to life. Who can say which is the beginning and which is the end? Who can say what love is? Who can dare to define its strange stranglehold on the human heart? A perilous stranglehold which we shake off at peril to the soul's survival, becoming literally dead souls. Love in a vacuum. Impossible. Rejoice then in the brief epiphanies of love we have experienced and may experience. Love, marriage, parenthood, and the various vicarious loyalties, the various vicarial betrayals. Leave me alone, though I know you won't, I know you won't, I know you won't. Love, the tug of inclinations, the tug of loyalties and disloyalties that magnify the mystery, solidify its weakness, or shatter its precarious strength. Love in the afternoon. Playing in the park with my young son aged 3 and a red football, love unbespoken grew viable as grass, spacious as unfenced acres. Then, slobbering, thumb in mouth, a mentally retarded Mongol boy of 8 interrupted our game, kicking the ball high in the air and whooping queer expletives when I tossed it back to him for a further unretarded kick at love's discrepancies. Meantime, my son, enraged at my fickle neglect, lay on his face in the grass, sobbing his angry dismay. Love, in the circumstances, unsure of its direction, wobbled, and, as frequently happens, came to a flat, but practical, stand still. A practical stand still, of course. Love must be practical, mustn't it? Of course, I love you. That goes without saying. Just wait and see, wait and see. Then, 3 years later, the accidental proof. The experience we could never premeditate. The experience we can never repudiate. The merge of shared suffering, shared isolation, shared desolation, shared heartache, shared consolation. Of sorts, of sorts. Love in the afternoon, too. The pediatrician explains the position, standing, understanding, beside your bed. He mentions cells, mutations, chromosomes. Impassive, bland as stones, we listen, eardrums bursting in our entrails. You finger the bedspread, I finger my tie with my right hand, clutch your elbow with my left. Bereft of expected joy, you cannot cry. You stare at the elliptic mouth, divine your newborn drouth. Love in the afternoon, love in the aftermath, destiny, pain or privilege, the alchemy of suffering, how it refines, how it purifies, how it eventually corrodes even the most staunch spirit. Unless, of course, we embrace it, unless we excise it, unless we love consciously. Love as discipline, love as giving, not receiving, possibly again. Possibly also total identification with the inner isolation of another, especially the child, especially one's own child. A burnt offering, then, a sacramental burnt offering that sears and strangely purifies the flagging heart. Father and son, child and man, flesh and flesh, spirit and spirit. A burnt offering of union and communion, a burnt offering of desperate hope, desperate dread, desperate caring, desperate sharing, desperate love. Children's Hour. Wide-eyed at Bozo's superhuman antics, you squat upon the carpet. Brash semantics of super-duper conflicts keep your gaze intact as chalk-eyed clowns scrap happy days. Accident. You screamed once as the scalding tea descended upon your tiny genitals, thighs, trunk. Frantic with ice cubes, water, sterile lint, I swab my fear with action. Bandage, guilt. Casualty department. Naked, sedated, you lie on your back, as expert eyes assess your tissue damage. Hand clutched in mine, you consecrate your panic. This is your body. Visiting hour. Legs, arms are bandaged, but your genitals are naked to aid healing. Visitors to other patients stare, squirm, back away. Penis distended, crusted with congealed sepsis, peeled testicles like overripe tomatoes. I tiptoe to your bedside, seek your eyes. Tearless, afraid, you let me share your turmoil. Nightmare. Your eyes are closed, exhausted invalid. Your breathing is more even. Your burnt flesh heals daily. Officially, I've been told, you're off the danger list. I sit and watch you sleeping in your antiseptic cot. Suddenly, you clutch the bars, jerk upright. Again, your child's scream wells our isolation. The agony of others, nearly experienced, involving ourselves. Leave me alone, don't leave me alone. Please, please help me. Help me back to safe unreality. This is too real, too unreal. Help me, help me, help. Or must there be another epiphany of suffering? Another experience of shared turmoil? Soon, maybe. Yes, and soon it was. Soon my real voyage of discovery would begin, but first my outward journey, my voluntary exile with all its excitement and all its challenge, then on to my interior journey, to the more exacting, more mysterious interior of the senses, where light and dark, dark and light beckon and reckon, burning in a molten furnace of unknowing, until all that we thought was lost is found again. But before this voluntary voyage, before my voluntary exile, two last epiphanies of personal commitment and personal abandonment and personal insight, father and son, two on a journey, together, separate, separate and together, together and separate, two on a journey of fear and hope, a journey of suffering and healing, a journey of loyalty and betrayal, two on a journey. Death supersedes, but illness conjugates love's treachery. In hospital aged eight for tonsillectomy, comics, toy soldiers, dates, black grapes and oranges ignored, I wept in hate of visitor's trestle kindness, knowing this, betrayal flicked from mother's parting kiss. Time codifies. Accompanying my son, aged three, in an insufferably bland ambulance to hospital, a metal gun, death dedicate, clutched in his clammy hand. Assuring him that I won't go away, I watch his triggered gaze sustain my lie. Thus, plush betrayal rides the mettled way with love, and death is not the real enemy. Father and son, son and father, sad the frail distance between them, sometimes never bridged till death miraculously solders as it severs, miraculously heals as it ransacks, and suddenly today is tomorrow, and father and son have bridged the frail distance that separated them before, have recognized each other at last, are alone and together, joined in newfound understanding and love. Tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. My father's grave I've never visited. Now why is that? Is that a Freudian omen? Some dark hint of something hidden, smothered, mothered even out of existence, as he was, I will be, also. It's true that father mattered less than mother when both alive were. Childhood, how it conceals, repeals our curling consciences. Then lo, one day, they stricture, presto. Mother's life was structured, unlike father's. He chain-smoked, limousine to dusky death. She remedied all pain, all sadness, suffering, with song and gaiety, yes, and bedtime stories, by firelight, after dark, most happy, one grotesque. My mamma bet me, my dada et me, my two little sisters pick my bones and bury them under the marble stones. A marble headstone father got, all shiny polished, with black indented letters, sunlight glinting. In loving memory, Michael, devoted husband, father, may perpetual light shine upon him, de profundis. Perpetual light to light perpetual dark, yes, that's a consummation to be wished, Lord Hamlet would concede. O father, father, tomorrow and tomorrow I will visit, vindicate your brave grave resting place, take my lone preview of dark and light fantastic, sift the socketings. Then, one day, presto. When other lips and other hearts their tales of love shall tell, in language whose excess imparts the power they feel so well, there may perhaps
Ha ha ha.